You are now going to listen to KAZI Book Review with Hopeton Hay.
In The Hour of Fate, Susan Burfield portrays the momentous legal battle between President Theodore Roosevelt and the most powerful investment banker in the nation, J.P. Morgan, over the government's ability to restrict agreements between companies that would lead to monopolies in their markets. In the book, Burfield provides the background stories of Roosevelt and Morgan and their roots in wealthy families, their rise to power, and their divergent paths when it came to big business. Susan Burfield is an award-winning feature writer and investigative reporter. The Hour of Fate is her first book. Susan Burfield, welcome to KAZI Book Review.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So Theodore Roosevelt was actually put into the vice presidency because they were trying to minimize his influence. And as I was reading through your book, businessmen who wanted the status quo to stay the status quo were always looking for ways to suppress the influence and power of Theodore Roosevelt. But I would imagine, not even imagine, they were shocked when McKinley was assassinated by anarchists in 1901, and probably pretty fearful initially of how Theodore Roosevelt would act toward business. But that didn't quite, at least initially, they actually thought he would play along with him.
Yeah. So, you know, when Roosevelt was put in the position of vice president, nominated at the convention, you know, his Republican colleagues in New York told McKinley and his campaign manager, like, yeah, you can take him. He's been a disturbing element in every situation. And if you can kind of neutralize him as a vice president, that would be great for everybody. And, you know, in New York, of course, Wall Street then as now was a dominant force and influence in politics. And so when Roosevelt became vice president, he himself said it was like putting on the veil. You know, he expected that this was kind of the beginning of political oblivion for him. At one point, even thought about studying law while he was vice president so that he could have a different career after his term ended. But of course, just a few months into it and before McKinley's first year was even up, McKinley was assassinated. Roosevelt was president, much to the real surprise and fear and anxiety of a lot of the people in New York and elsewhere, you know, who had hoped that they had kind of heard the last of him. Roosevelt was pretty good at taking advice, and all of the advice that he got in that September and October of 1901 was to be conservative, you know, and to make sure that people weren't worried about stability. And so to that end, he did promise to follow McKinley's policies. He kept McKinley's cabinet. And, you know, initially people believed that he had kind of come to see that as president, he couldn't be quite the reformer that he had always been. But that did not last long.
And so J.P. Morgan, everyone's heard of J.P. Morgan Chase Bank. That's a name that's been around forever. He was a second generation banker, and he looked at the presidency as secondary to the power of corporate America. But talk a little bit about the role that J.P. Morgan played in putting together these huge companies. I think the first big one I recall was him setting up U.S. Steel with Andrew Carnegie, who I believe at that time was the richest man in America, and put together these mergers. So J.P. Morgan spent a lot of time putting together these large corporations to minimize costly competition.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So Morgan, who preferred to go by Pierpont rather than JP, which is kind of great, by the time Roosevelt was reaching the peak of his political power, Morgan was well established as one of the most powerful and influential men, definitely in America and probably in the world. And mostly that was because he had control over a vast resources and a huge amount of money. And it wasn't his own personal money. He was wealthy, but as you say, he wasn't the wealthiest. But as a banker, he was involved in all of the big deals and the big industries of the time. Steel was one of them. Railroads, which we'll talk about later, was the other. And, you know, as the 20th century began, Morgan had created the first billion-dollar company, which was a steel company. And then in the very early months of Roosevelt's presidency, Morgan created the second biggest company in the world, which was a railroad company. And so that's the world, the economic landscape that Roosevelt was operating in. It was when power and wealth was being concentrated in the hands of a few men, and Morgan was really chief among them.
So when we think about J.P. Morgan, I read his biography many, many, many years ago. And to think one person could save the United States financially by putting together banks, is there any person that you would compare J.P. Morgan to today? Does anyone have the kind of influence over the financial markets that could basically save the United States the way J.P. Morgan did financially?
You know, I really don't think so. And, you know, in part, that's by design, you know, because the U.S. government did really rely on Morgan not once but twice to bail out a government that was, you know, in the first case running out of gold. And then in the second case, there was just a big banking calamity. And Morgan was really the only one who could draw the resources needed. And that was great and welcome at the time, but also pretty scary for a lot of people. And so the second time that Morgan really bailed out the country in 1907, you know, that was the beginning of a pretty slow process, but eventually ended up with the Federal Reserve and a lot of institutions that do what Morgan himself did.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to KAZI Book Review on KAZI 88.7 FM. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is Susan Burfield. We're talking about her book, The Hour of Fate, Theodore Roosevelt, J.P. Morgan, and the Battle to Transform American Capitalism. Now, the industry of the time, the dominant industry, was the railroad industry. And what was unique about that industry was literally turning the United States into a unified country. Talk a bit about the railroad industry. I do know there was a Pulitzer Prize winning biography of Vanderbilt that was written maybe back, actually it was published back in 2009. And at one point he was, I believe, the richest man in America. So to give people understanding of the scale of the give us an understanding of the scale of the importance of the railroad industry to the United States.
Sure. So, the railroads were Apple, they were Microsoft, they were Google, they were YouTube. You know, they connected people for purposes of commerce, for purposes of communication. You know, as the railroads were built across the country, you know, they helped standardize time. You know, they created a need for public schools where railroad clerks could be educated. And, you know, they changed the whole geography of opportunity and wealth in the country, because if a railroad came through your town, you know, you could expect a certain amount of prosperity. And of course, towns were built up around the railroads. And so it's really hard to overstate the importance of the railroads beginning after the Civil War and right up through the period that we're talking about, the turn of the early 20th century. The railroads drew in huge resources, you know, both the land that they were given from the government and the money that investors put into it. Because it was such a huge opportunity, and you can almost think of it as like the dot-com era here, where a lot of people were involved in building maybe just small little railroad lines, you know, that competed with each other, that ran parallel. There were, you know, different gauges of tracks. You know, it was a very kind of haphazard, reckless, exciting time. And like all of those times, there was reckonings. And, you know, the United States went through a couple of big depressions, a lot of strikes, and at the root of that was really the railroad and the railroad industry. So to a certain point, Morgan got involved in that. He helped bankrupt railroads reorganize, and so there was a process that was called Morganization rather than reorganization. And once he did that, you know, he put his men on the board of directors, and he retained control at every move. You know, he may not have attended every board meeting, but everyone knew that Morgan was keeping an eye on the railroads. And, you know, that made investors feel a little less anxious, but it also left consumers and, you know, people on the railroads a little uneasy about the power that he had over something that was so important to their daily lives.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to KAZI Book Review on KAZI 88.7 FM. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is Susan Burfield. She is the author of The Hour of Fate, Theodore Roosevelt, J.P. Morgan, and The Battle to Transform American Capitalism. So I was looking at your bio, and you don't have a degree in history. You have a master's in international affairs, I believe a bachelor's in psychology. So I have to ask, how did you decide to become a historian with this book?
Yeah, so I've been a business journalist for more than 20 years. Right now, I'm an investigative reporter at Bloomberg Businessweek and Bloomberg News. So for the past years, I've been writing about people in power, people grasping for power, people losing power, and, you know, who holds people in power to account. And so back in 2016, I was thinking about writing a book. I was looking around. You know, it seemed to me that there was a quickening sense of inequity. Big business was starting to be regarded as a problem that had to be reckoned with. Of course, Bernie Sanders was running for president. And so I started to look for the beginnings of some of this, you know, what Sanders was calling for at the time, you know, what Elizabeth Warren and he were calling for more recently, and what I think has become a little bit more of a mainstream idea, you know, is that businesses have to be held to a bit stricter account, and that the government has to do more for a lot of people than it's been doing. And so, you know, you can argue if we're in a real progressive moment now, but it got me thinking about the first progressive moments and looking back to Roosevelt and Morgan, to the conflicts they had, to, you know, the one instance when they were able to cooperate, and, you know, realizing that the way that their conflicts were resolved really had a huge impact on the country then and now. And so, yeah, I took a leap, you know, as a journalist who's used to being able to call people up when you want to hear from them, or, you know, I'm used to looking at documents and used to having to dig around. So I tried to apply, you know, most of those skills to this book. But also I had to learn a lot, for sure.
Well, it's a really entertaining story. It's certainly a history book that can capture the attention not only of history geeks like me, but the general public. And so when you were writing the book, were you working to make sure that even though it was a book about something that happened in the 1901, that it was accessible to the general public, because some people today really don't find history as interesting and as important as, say, you do?
Absolutely. You know, I think as a journalist, I've always tried to, you know, make my writing accessible and to explain issues, you know, that can be complicated, stories, you know, that have twists and turns. But, you know, I always think about characters, and I think about the tension, and I think about a narrative. I try to write for the magazine, you know, in a way that people will read to the end of a story. You know, I want a story to have a beginning, middle, and end. And so I thought about all of that in the same way. And I wanted to bring the characters to life. You know, I wanted there to be dialogue. I wanted there to be scenes. I wanted to maintain tension through the book, you know, so that while everyone knows what's going to happen, it happened more than 150 years ago, that there would be surprises along the way.
So one of the stories you tell in the book was how Roosevelt sent Knox, who I believe was the attorney general, to Florida, and correct me if I have his title wrong there, publicly ordering him to rest in the southern wharf and privately instructing him to review recent business combinations to see if any defied the antitrust law. So Roosevelt had plans, but he didn't mention any of that in his initial State of the Union message. But he had plans to attack this Northern Securities, or not Northern Securities, ultimately he did, of course. But he was really looking to enforce the Sherman Antitrust Act, which was passed in 1890.
Right. So, you know, as we were talking about, there was a real concentration of wealth and power in just a few people's hands. And that was, you know, through these monopolies and trusts, which are essentially, you know, another word for monopoly, or kind of a big business that has pretty dominant influence over its industry. And there were monopolies and trusts for all kinds of things. I mean, we've talked about railroad and steel and oil. Those were the big ones. But then for many smaller things too, you know, whiskey, lead, paper bags, you know, rope. So everything was being combined and controlled by a few people. And there were a lot of Americans who were very unsettled by this. Roosevelt was one of them. When he took office as president, he realized that there was a lot of federal power and authority that hadn't really been used, or had been used infrequently. And Roosevelt decided that he was going to try to enforce this Sherman Antitrust Act, you know, that there was laws on the books, and he wanted to test it. And he needed a test case. Northern Securities was a railroad company that Morgan had worked to form from three railroads, and it would have dominated rail traffic in the northwest of the country, which was becoming very prosperous, was very important to Morgan, but important to the country and important to Roosevelt. And the formation of the company was the result in part of a big hostile takeover and a panic in the stock market. So unlike many other times when Morgan created deals and it was very much behind the scenes and people only knew about it when he made the announcement, the panic in the stock market had been so huge and dramatic, and people lost a lot of money, that everyone knew that there was conflict and tension among these railroads, and that that was something that Morgan could never abide, you know, because that was bad for profit making. You know, he was a capitalist, but he didn't always believe in competition. He really believed in cooperation, if people were cooperating with him. And so when Northern Securities was announced, it was in November, just 2 months after Roosevelt had taken office. It was a company whose origins had been rooted in conflict, and it had been very public and bitter, and Morgan was at the head of it. So by all those measures, it had a lot to recommend itself to Roosevelt. But of course, he wanted to make sure that if the government brought this case, it'd be very high profile, you know, against Morgan, one of the most powerful people in the country, a company that everybody knew about. And he wanted to make sure that the government could win. So he sent his attorney general, Knox, right down to Florida without telling anybody, to review all the documents and to make sure that if they brought the case, that they could win it.
And J.P. Morgan was so upset about it. And he basically commented, as you write in the book, that Roosevelt should have called him and they could have worked it out. I mean, J.P. Morgan expected the president to call him to work it out on the side, as opposed to enforcing the Antitrust Act.
Absolutely. You know, Morgan was used to being able to make deals on his yacht and in his drawing room in his lovely mansion on Madison Avenue, he was not used to being surprised, which he was. You know, he was not used to being held to account, which he was. And, you know, he and Roosevelt had traveled in similar social circles. Roosevelt was a generation younger. And I think Morgan thought Roosevelt was pretty unpredictable, untrustworthy. And, you know, in Morgan's view, this just cemented all of that. When Morgan found out that the government intended to file suit, yeah, he went down to Washington, had a meeting with Roosevelt, and basically said, you know, send your man to my man to fix this up. You know, we shouldn't be doing this in public. This is something we should be resolving privately.
Wow. During that time period, the courts often made decisions in favor of big business, and it points to how the so-called impartial judges that are being appointed for life actually are representing philosophically at least certain ideas. And what it seems to me is if we look at what was happening then, and I'm going to use this in an exaggerated sense, but sort of a ruling of a plutocracy where, because when you look at how much money influenced elections and a selection of judges at the turn of the century during what I would call the Robert Barron era, and how much money influences elections today, especially in light of the Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission Supreme Court decision of 2010, which basically allowed corporations to make as much money donations as they wanted to within certain contexts. But money really drives often the selection of the judiciary system. So it almost seems that if we look at then and today, that we've gotten out of balance again.
Yeah. You know, it was interesting to me to read about the Supreme Court. Obviously, it was an important part of the book. And there's a few judges in particular that, you know, are featured. But overall, when presidents appointed judges, you know, they did so believing that the judges that they appointed would rule in their favor. And, you know, at the time, many of the judges had been corporate lawyers. You know, some of them had experience as judges, but many of them were pretty sympathetic to business claims and overall could very fairly say that the court at the highest level, but also at the lower levels, were very business friendly. And, you know, it's one reason why there had been sporadic and an uneven enforcement of important laws regulating business. You know, for that matter, many of the attorneys general before Knox also came from the corporate world and were reluctant to enforce the Sherman antitrust law. Now, Knox, too, was a corporate lawyer, but he believed that there was a role for the government in the business world. And, you know, he was also very eager to serve his client and to show that he could, you know, enforce a law that maybe other lawyers thought that they wouldn't be able to.
You mentioned earlier that J.P. Morgan expected Theodore Roosevelt to conduct himself in a certain way because they both were from very well-known wealthy families. What was it about Theodore Roosevelt's experiences that sort of pushed him to become, as Franklin Roosevelt was once referred to, as a traitor to his class?
Yeah, it's a pretty interesting evolution because he saw all the sides of New York. You know, I think Morgan, when he lived in New York, lived in a bubble. You know, he didn't travel the way that that Roosevelt traveled. He didn't go down to the Lower East Side where there are immigrants and tenement housing, a lot of poverty. Roosevelt also grew up with a father who was a reformer and a philanthropist and had brought Roosevelt from a young age down to those areas so that he could begin to see, you know, what the city was like, what the country was like, and what his responsibilities were. So I think Roosevelt grew up with a sense that he had a responsibility to the city at large, the country at large. And I think Morgan's sense of responsibility was often to his investors, the people who trusted him with their money. And then more broadly, he too felt a responsibility to the country and to help it industrialize and become powerful and take its place in the global stage. So I think that, you know, they both had a sense of responsibility, but it was very, very different. And I think, you know, Roosevelt ultimately described his presidency as, you know, fighting for the abolition of privilege. And I think you could argue in a lot of ways that Morgan wanted to maintain those privileges.
What are the most important things you want readers to get out of your book?
Ah, that's a great question. Well, you know, I think any history, you know, that wants, and I think most do, to be relevant to readers in its time, you know, I think the sense is that, you know, for me, the story that I was looking for in 2016, you know, that I'm telling now in 2020, really began in 1902. And there were a lot of tensions in the country that we feel now in terms of inequity, social justice, concentration of power, you know, a divide between, you know, cities and countryside and, you know, East Coast and West and middle of the country. You know, there's many, many different ways you can look at it. But I think overall, you know, what I hope is that, you know, in 1902, there was the beginning of change. You know, Roosevelt asked, like, what makes a just country? You know, how can America become more just? He wanted to offer a square deal. And I think there's a lot of people in America now who are asking the same thing. You know, there's a lot that's different. Obviously, America's a lot more complicated country, a lot more diverse country. We've been through a lot more. We have experience with different kinds of reform programs. But I think overall, you know, it's, again, it's a question that we're asking, you know, how can we make America more fair? How can we have an economy that works for everybody? So I hope that readers, when they look at a book like this, you know, will realize the country's been through this again, but just because you've answered those questions once doesn't mean that we don't have to answer them again.
Susan Burfield, author of The Hour of Fate, Theodore Roosevelt, J.P. Morgan, and the Battle to Transform American Capitalism. What's your website?
Oh, thank you. SusanBurfield.com. And I would say that, you know, in a time when authors, myself included, can't travel to bookstores, I'm very happy to, like, sign inscriptions for people. And if they want to leave a message for me with their address, I can send them a signed book plate.
Well, thanks again for being a guest on KZI Book Review.
Thank you so much. It was a real pleasure to talk with you.
Thanks for listening to this podcast edition of KAZI Book Review. Be sure to like my Facebook page entitled KAZI Book Review, and my Twitter handle is @KAZI Books, and my Instagram handle is KAZI_book_review. Have a great day.